Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and today's program is going to get you a traveling good. And a lot of excitement.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Indeed. Once every 5 years, right?
Yeah.
Same frequency as elections in Britain. I never really did understand why it was an odd number of years. It didn't used to be. It used to be different than that.
You know, we're talking about the World's Fair, which is also called the Milano Expo 2015. And Dorothy Hamilton always has great insights, and she shares with you all the excitement about this upcoming event.
And we're going to make a good effort. It's going to be a big show for the USA, so you're going to want to listen to the details. I'm sure you'll be very interested.
Dorothy Hamilton, you always wear so many different hats. Your basic one, though, is the president of the International Culinary Institute in New York City, but you're also now president, I understand, of the USA Pavilion at Expo Milano 2015.
That's correct. That's very correct. I must have my head examined because they're two full-time jobs, but I'm loving every minute of it.
I said that to Mitch Davis. He has probably four hats he's wearing.
Well, he's so brilliant, he can handle them all.
Yeah, I guess it's tough, though. Well, anyhow, I'm very excited about this, and I'm glad that you're coming on the menu to talk about the plans for this. It's creeping up real fast.
It is. It's going to open May 1st, so that's, 70-odd days away.
Wow.
And it's going to run for 6 months. Until October 31st. And for your listeners, to put it in perspective, the world calls this an expo, an exposition. But we've always in this country called them World's Fair. So if people can remember the New York World's Fair, the Seattle World's Fair, and to read about the illustrious ones in St. Louis and Chicago, and the original ones in London and Paris. The Eiffel Tower was built for a World's Fair in that expo in Paris back in the 19th century. And so they go on every 5 years somewhere around the world. Just like the Olympics are every 4 years, the expos are every 5 years.
Oh, I was not sure about that. Thanks for explaining that one. Every 5 years, okay.
Every 5 years, and it always has a theme. So the last one was in Shanghai, and people might remember that. It was around the time of the Beijing Olympics, too. They had the Shanghai Expo, and they were exploring then the technology sector. This time, it's in Milan, 5 years later, 2015, and we're exploring energy and food issues. So the official title is Feeding the Planet, Energy for Life. Every country is going to address how will we feed 9 billion people in 2050.
Wow. Now, how many countries are participating?
146. I believe, at this time. It might go up. Might go down a little. It's around that size.
Now, the U.S. Pavilion, you said it's going to be one of the best we've ever had. Tell us about that, because we're interested in our presentation to the world.
Well, the reason I say it might be the best we've ever had is not really with thumping our chests too much, but I do think one of the reasons for that is usually when a country goes into the World's Fair, the main thought is about the pavilion itself. There are iconic pavilions, and not as much thought goes into the software. Because if you look at World's Fairs, they're always showing you, here's the American pavilion, here's the British pavilion, and it's a very big architectural fair. But since Mitchell Davis from the James Beard Foundation and myself from the International Culinary Center, we're both educators and celebrators of the food world. But as educators, we also take on the major and thorny issues in the food world. And so we attack this before we had a building on substantive issues. And so we've put as much into the software as we have into the hardware. And the hardware is spectacular. We're not going to be slumping on that at all. We have one of the most award-winning architects, Jim Bieber from Bieber Designs. He did the Harley-Davidson Museum in Milwaukee. He also did the Glass House Tourist Center up in Connecticut.
Oh, yeah.
And he's considered one of the best museum architects. And in addition, we've received, we've managed to attract Think to do our exhibit designs, and they were the exhibit designers for the 9/11 Museum.
Oh, wow.
So we have world-class people working on this. And the structure itself, all the pavilions are long rectangular structures. And American Pavilion is going to have a green wall. But it's not only going to have a green wall. It's going to be the largest vertical farm in the world.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be the size of a football field. And just think about taking a football field, ripping it up and putting it on its side, and then planting it. But it's not only going to just be planted and look like one big field. It's going to look patchwork quilt. So we can have companion plantings. It's going to be revolutionary because it's a disruptor, this farm. It's being used right now out in Wyoming. And, of course, the plants are growing in tubes hydroponically. But where this disrupts is we don't harvest it, package it, and take it to the grocery store. What this farm does is you take the tubes out, you put them in a truck, and you take them to the grocery store. So this is being done in Wyoming in a Whole Foods store right now. And people can go in and harvest their own vegetables.
Wow.
So that cuts down on packaging, and also there's no waste because anything that's not harvested goes immediately into composting. The efficiency is wonderful. So we're going to be showing American ingenuity like that. The other thing is we're going to have two floors of exhibits and a roof to party on. And so the two floors of exhibits, the middle floor is actually going to be made of the Coney Island Boardwalk.
Ah.
We purchased the salvaged Coney Island Boardwalk. One of the more exciting parts is boardwalk that we're going to have. The second floor of the pavilion is going to be the repurposed Coney Island Boardwalk. We purchased the boardwalk after Hurricane Sandy. And so a boardwalk is a place where America comes to relax, walk, stroll, eat. And so that's the feeling we would like to get. And Think, the exhibit designers, are designing 8 stanchions where you will go and learn about different policy, our best and brightest policy, innovators, chefs, technology, addressing the issue of how do we feed the world in 2050. We're very much talking about food security, climate change, all of these very big issues because we have to take them on if indeed we will have the energy to feed the world in 2050. We also have to look to nutrition and how we're feeding people and the responsibility of that. So it's a very exciting walkthrough on this boardwalk. When you finish, you're going to descend into a copse of Native American trees, and you're going to be hearing Native American chanting. And we're going to celebrate the biodynamics of the three sisters, you know, the corn, the bean sprout, and the squash plantings that
exactly.
all fed off each other. And we maybe have to look backwards to move forwards. And then we're going to go downstairs into an exhibit that is going to be, the pavilion's about 2 city blocks long. And it will be walking through the Great American Foodscape. And you'll be greeted by an Italian-American family eating their Italian-American food. And we're going to talk to the immigrant experience of how every wave of immigrants that have come to this country have brought their food with them. And we've all benefited from it. I think a lot of Americans think pizza and pasta are American dishes, not Italian dishes. And then we're going to talk to the peculiarities of American eating. I think something about eating on the run, grab and go, how Americans like to pick up their breakfast and eat it while walking down the street. I think Europeans and the rest of the world are going to find that very amusing.
It is amazing.
And the centerpiece of the American landscape is going to be a Thanksgiving table. And you're going to walk in and you're going to see the traditional Thanksgiving table, but through technology, it's going to more or less implode on itself. And then all of a sudden, you're going to see the Chinese Thanksgiving table with rice on it. Or you're going to see the Italian Thanksgiving table that will have pasta on that table. And then as you walk through the rest of it, we'll be celebrating different regions of the country, barbecue, artisanal food and beverage makers, various chefs. So the purpose of the Great American Foodscape is really to show the public, we expect 3 million people, 2 to 3 million people to walk through our pavilion, to show them what American food really is like. And then, and on the roof, we will have, there'll be a bar and a cafe, and we'll be able to do events up there. But maybe the secret weapon of the pavilion is going to be the 120 student ambassadors. With the University of Southern California, USC, we've recruited 120 college-age ambassadors who are bi and trilingual, who will be the docents and guides through the pavilion.
Wow.
Now, so that, I'm sorry to just go on like a monologue, but that's an overview.
It's fascinating.
No, aside from the student ambassadors that you just talked about, is it going to be, the booth going to be staffed with American companies with food products for sale or?
Not really. We'll have a very small retail shop where we'll sell things, you know, related to the expo or American branded things like t-shirts and baseball hats and pins if people want a memento.
But that's low-keyed. Right. That's good.
Yeah, there's no food being sold in the pavilion. There, other than the mementos, no products being sold. However, we do have another plot of land on the expo grounds, and it's very close to our pavilion, and we're calling it Food Truck Nation.
Yeah, that's what.
And we will be operating six food trucks. Yeah, and those food trucks will serve, one will serve hamburgers and hot dogs, another will serve lobster rolls and fried clams, another will serve tacos, and the fourth will serve barbecue. The fifth and sixth will have beverages and desserts. And so we feel that at the exposition itself, we would rather show our casual food. And then we are going to bring our dream team of chefs over to Milan, but what we're going to run a restaurant in Milan itself, downtown in central Milan.
How did you do that?
Well, we found out that the pavilion really wasn't big enough to have a first-class exhibit and a first-class dining room. And we wanted to show really the breadth of American food and not just our fine dining and our fine chefs. And so we came up with this very, I think, innovative plan to sort of take over a restaurant in downtown Milan and bring our chefs over and have them cook. And so we're lining up a stellar group, everyone from Rick Bayless in Chicago to Mario Batali. And so Daniel Hum from 11 Madison is coming. We have Mary Sue Milliken from L.A. Right. So as we speak, the chefs are giving us their dates. And Mitchell's over in Milan today working on getting all of this together.
This is sort of like a pop-up then, I guess you would call it. Really.
Yes, it would be a six-month pop-up. Yeah. And you'll be able to buy tickets online to go to this. This isn't a reservation type thing. So if you're planning to come to the expo, and if you're a foodie, I would say you will really kick yourself if you don't. But you can go to our website, which is www.usapavilion2015.net, N-E-T.
Net, okay.
Okay, and there you'll see pictures of our gorgeous pavilion. It will describe our philosophy and the issues that we're tackling in the pavilion. And I don't think our tickets have gone on sale yet for the restaurant. I think that will be closer to May because we don't have our lineup of chefs all locked in.
Right.
But people should keep going back. And I would encourage anybody who is interested in going to the expo to make their hotel reservations as soon as possible.
Oh, that's good.
They are expecting 20 to 30 million visitors expo.
Hold on just a second. Dorothy, where is does the expo take place? Near the existing Milan Convention Center? Because I booked a hotel there.
Well, it's actually in the fairgrounds. It's in between the airport and the central city. And it's about 30 to 40 minutes from the Duomo. The Duomo is the cathedral in the middle of Milan. So they have excellent public transportation out to the fairgrounds. It's 30, 40 minutes from the center of Milan. So as long as you get on the right subway, the metro, you'll be okay. The other thing they have is if you can't stay in Milan, if you stay in Turin, they have the high-speed train that will be going directly from Turin directly to the expo.
Yeah, that might make sense, actually.
Yes, so you can, you know, and I think it's about an hour and 15 minutes. It's not that long. And so if you couldn't or don't want to stay in Milan, or you want to stay in the outlying region, you can, because the fairgrounds themselves are not in the city. They're in the outskirts. And I would say to position yourself and say, exactly where is it? Look on a map where Milan Airport is and where the city is, and it's kind of in the middle between the two there.
Well, okay. Now, how would you, I don't know how you would ever wrap your head around doing that, and I mean, if you're coming from the United States, and then seeing a spattering of all the other pavilions, I mean, how much time would you allocate to this trip?
I would say minimum 2 days, and then depending on how much you're devoted to these issues, I would say 3 or 4 days should do it. The Italians have been very, very smart about the way they've set this up. It's a very long, like, a mile long, and all the pavilions are off this one long road. Uh-huh. Figure the Via Appia. It's called the Decumanus. And you just walk down there and you can pop in to each of the pavilions. None of the pavilions can charge any money, I think. You can go online and buy the daily ticket, which, depending on if you go through a group or if you're buying it online, it's about $40 to $60 for the day.
So you buy a ticket to the entrance.
To the expo.
Yeah.
Or you can buy it there at the expo. And so... But and that gives you free entry to all the pavilions.
Well, I mean, it just sounds marvelous.
yeah, it is. It's good. It's so exciting.
It is exciting. And what about what kinds of opening ceremonies are there going to be?
For the actual opening, they have Andrea Bocelli singing. I think Armani is sponsoring the opening night for the whole expo. Every country, and there are 140, will have a national day where they'll celebrate. Ours is going to be July 4th. The USC marching band is coming over to help us celebrate. So there'll be lots of events going on around the expo. They're keeping La Scala open the whole time the expo's open.
Now, that's
so
what you should
opera buffs who want to come to Milan will find, you know, that they can go to the Scala if they get their tickets, you know, fast enough.
Don't expect to see the Last Supper, though.
Oh, yeah. No, it's going to be quite an eventful 6 months.
Yes.
So whenever you come, there will be things going on.
Well, I mean, I'm just flabbergasted. It sounds so much fun.
It is. If you're a foodie, you have to Milan 2015.
Anyhow, any other contact information that the listeners should know about, Dorothy?
I just think if you go to our website,
you get all the
www.usapavilion2015.net, you can get lots of information and you can contact us.
And you know, it's on Twitter.
It's on Twitter. We have a blog feed. There's a lot of, I believe we have all those links, Facebook, Twitter. You can follow us. We do, we talk about issues leading up to. We're also going to be holding panels and TED-like talks while we're there to really capture the knowledge of all the famous people that are and experts that will be visiting the expo. So just if you just keep going to our website, you'll be able to keep up to date.
Well, I can't wait, and I didn't know Peter already made a hotel reservation.
Oh, good. When are you coming?
Well, Anne said she wanted to be there close to the beginning, and the difficulty is there's a conflict with the James Beard Awards in Chicago.
Yeah. Oh, you're right.
So I figured we would go to Chicago first, and then go straight across, and.
You're hearing this before I did, Dorothy.
Yeah, well,
right. Well, it sounds like a fun time, Chicago, yeah, then Milan.
Well, I didn't buy.
And you know what? Chicago and Milan are sister cities.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Okay. Anyway, I didn't buy the plane tickets yet, but I did book a room. And I'll have to go back now and figure out if it's in the right place.
All right.
Oh, Dorothy, thank you so much for talking to us and telling us all about it and getting us all excited. And I'm glad you're having a good time, too.
Okay. All right. Well, it's a pleasure talking to you.
Again, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
It sure sounds like a lot of excitement, a lot of fun.
Yes.
big crowds, too, no doubt. But we're planning on being there, and I think we would advise you to make your plans early if you're going to be there. But it sounds like it's going to be a very worthwhile visit. and not just waving our own flag, but looking at what other nations, 146 of them around the globe, are doing about the pending crisis in the world's food supply. So we'll bring you more about that from the site itself when May rolls around. We may even have conversations before about more as we find out more details. But now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our guest actually talking to Amelia Tarani, who's representing the Silver Spoon. We were pretty early in touring Puglia. We were sort of early pioneers in that part of Italy, and it's now catching on. It has so many charming aspects to it. Listen and learn about Puglia now.
Oh, and there are two. Let's emphasize there are two aspects of it, because the Silver Spoon series itself sounds like it's just cookbooks, but in fact,
it's far
more than that. It's a guide to the culture and history of each region that's covered, and the Puglia book is an excellent example, and the kind of book I wish we'd had when we were planning to go there for the first time, and when we go back, we'll certainly count on using it. So here's Puglia in the words of Silver Spoon and Amelia
Tarani. To my surprise, Amelia Tarani, I looked up the last time we interviewed you for On the Menu Radio, and it was in February, aired February 12th, 2006.
And we're still going, and you're still going.
Yeah, definitely. We interviewed you at that time about the big Silver Spoon cookbook, right?
Yes.
Which is, you explained at the time, the equivalent of the joy of cooking, that every Italian bride got a copy of this book.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's a book that was published in Italy the first time in the 50s.
Uh-huh.
And then has been continuously updated, and it's always been in print. And in 2005, actually, we published for the first time an American edition.
Okay, that's about when we started talking about it. That's
exactly
right. Now, as you were explaining, maybe you can explain for our listeners. I mean, that was the original publication, the all-purpose, all-around Italian cookbook.
Yeah, it only had like 1,000 recipes.
Yeah, it was a big cookbook. But now it's a series. Could you explain what the series includes so far?
Yes. We talk about Italian cuisine, and of course there are a lot of recipes that you can find all over the country. But then what is specific about Italy is that every single region have kind of core recipes that are really related to that region, because it's used, they're using the ingredients that are from the region, because they are traditional. And sometimes you find even different recipes from one town to another. So there is this very strong specificity of regional cuisine. So we thought that it would be interesting to introduce the American audience to the differences that you have in the region. And starting with the regions that people love the most, and the first one was actually Tuscany, that was a little bit of a given, because clearly it's one of the most famous, it's very popular, people go. And then going in other regions that are as beautiful, as interesting from a food point of view, but probably less known, but nevertheless still very, very interesting and emerging also from a tourist point of view. Second one was Sicily.
Okay.
And we are now publishing a new one on Puglia.
And that's the one we're supposed to be talking about today. But are you going to be publishing all the regions of Italy in this Silver Spoon series?
Eventually, yes.
And at what rate? I mean, how frequently?
Well, we are doing it once a year. So because there are 22 regions in Italy, maybe we should do it a little bit faster.
It would take 22 years.
Now, this one has Basilicata included as well, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the idea of the book is that it's not only about the food. It's really presenting the region through the food. So it's you have the recipes, of course, with beautiful images, but also you have a sense of the landscape, the produce, the architecture, the cities, the art. So it's a kind of journey through the region. For someone who is interested in food, so food is clearly the main topic of the book, but also give a complete overview of the region.
No, I wish the book had been in print when we went there. We went to Puglia in 1998. I think we went because we had some friends who had been to that part of Italy for the first time, and they told us how wonderful it was, and they thought that Alba Rebelli was the most heavenly place on the planet. And
it's recently has been a little bit more popular, but I believe that when you were there, there was probably very, very few foreigners.
There were very few tourists. The curiously enough, the town that we probably liked the least was Alba Rebelli, because that was
the most touristy.
Because that was somewhat overrun with tourists.
Of course, with all the truly.
But we stayed for the first two or three days in Barletta, and and my nose reminds me, because as you drive to the north from Barletta towards the Gargano Peninsula, all you can smell is the garlic growing in the fields by the roadside. So I do remember that, and I remember something else, and I looked for it in your book, because I thought someone had told us it was a tradition, but I couldn't find it. So imagine that we're out to dinner. The first night we were in Puglia, in Barletta, we went to a restaurant called the Something Vecchio.
Yeah, they were all called Vecchio.
and we sat down at a table, and before we ordered anything to eat, really, dishes started to arrive. So we were on this long bench table. Well, only two of us. It would have seated 12 people. But by the time we got around to ordering our main course, the table was covered with antipasti. And somebody told us the tradition was that you were supposed to have about 12. Now is that correct or not?
Yeah, no, it is. It is in some cities. It's very important the number. There is also some superstitions in all the Kabbalah numbers and so on. And there are in some region and in some parts of the region, they are really, really keen on having the 12 as the luck number and so on.
Okay, so what we discovered and what somebody told us is actually correct. And it's a good thing for potential diners to know that, because if you're going to do justice to the main course, you better go easy on the appetizers.
Was that the place where they gave us this? They brought a special fish.
That was another. Yeah, it was curious.
About to be the whole restaurant.
Well, we went further south. We went all the way a long way south from Barletta. Went through Bari, and then on the way back there was a fire. There was a brush fire that closed the road, so we were very late getting to the restaurant, but fortunately they were still open when we got there. And then we had this whole ceremony over the big fish, and wanted to have a whole fish, and the chef in the kitchen wanted to have a whole fish, but it was a very large fish.
It was enough for everybody.
So the chef brought the fish out into the restaurant and paraded it around until he got enough people to order it. Until he got enough people to order it.
And then he cooked it.
It was worth cooking.
We're still selling it.
So, now, every region of Italy, I mean, it's really interesting for Americans, because Americans had just one idea of Italy. And yes. Lydia Bastianich makes it. She wrote a whole book about the American Italian or Italian American cuisine, the red sauce cuisine. But then they started doing regional, but they always did just northern Italy, if you remember. So now all of a sudden, southern Italy is becoming popular.
Yeah, also because there is a much wide variety of ingredients that are also so delicious. And for me it's interesting because when I left Italy and I moved first to the UK, I heard all these people talking about local ingredients and eating seasonal. And I was wondering, that's what we do normally. I mean, when I grew up, I never had a tomato in January.
No.
Or I never had things that they were not growing locally. Because this is, it's normal. It's what the cuisine is built around. So, and because Italy is so long and it's so different in terms of landscaping, in terms of terroir, in terms of climate, there are different things that grows in different parts of the country. And the entire regional cuisine is built around these ingredients. And especially in this, it's very interesting because in a region sometimes you have both, you have the sea, but you have also the mountain,
yes,
you have the hill, you have, so there is this, this creating recipes right around the ingredient that grows in your backyard. And especially Puglia has a huge production of olive oil that is fabulous.
Yes.
It's absolutely incredible. So a lot of the recipes are built around the good use of very good olive oil. And then it goes also with for the tomatoes, for the burrata, for all these products that are typical of the region.
Yeah, now I read in this book that actually this one particular type of tomato grown in Puglia as the largest production of tomatoes. I always thought it was San Marzano, but
yeah, in Naples.
Yeah, but your book says that this particular brand is from
Foggia. Yeah, from Puglia. Yeah,
from Foggia. You said, I think.
Foggia.
From Foggia specifically.
From Foggia.
I think
yeah.
You said.
Is that true?
Yeah. No. It is. It is, and it's also. I think it's one of the its greatest production of tomatoes that then goes into becoming canned tomatoes.
Well, that's what that you said here. Yeah.
Now you mentioned a little bit ago that I don't know whether we were on air yet or not that when you first went to Puglia, you went there on holiday to go to the beach.
Yeah, I was probably 5 years old, and my father, who was a very adventurous traveler, he decided that if we have to go to the seaside, we have to go to the most beautiful, wildest seaside that you can find in Italy. And we went to Puglia. And for many, many years, we were traveling throughout the region. And we went to Ostuni, we went to the Tremiti, we went to, we were, of course, visiting Foggia, and then Gargano, and then down to the Salento.
Yeah,
and it was wonderful.
The only thing that struck me about that area that was a real eyesore was the city of Taranto, which looks and smells really horrible and is really a blot on the landscape.
Yeah, it was a city where there were a lot of places where they were building naval ships and things like that, and it's not pretty.
No.
But there are many other that are incredible. I mean, there is in Foggia you have the most interesting Italian Baroque in architecture.
Right.
Really, really stunning.
Yeah, there's a beautiful cathedral in Trani.
Trani, yes, one of the ancient, actually.
Now, Bari, we found, was rather bustling, and we didn't really care for it all that well.
Yeah, but then you have a lot of these small villages, like Ostuni, that is this white village that is hanging on a hill,
uh-huh.
And it's absolutely extraordinary. It's a jewel.
Yeah, we stayed in the small town of Otranto.
Yeah, Otranto, yeah.
Which is about as far east as you can get in Italy.
Yeah, and it's also, it's interesting because it's where the two sea then converge, because
right.
You have the Adriatic and the Mediterranean.
Now, what was curious enough, what was happening then was there were a lot of people who were trying to escape communist Albania.
It's so close. It's really, really close to Albania.
Well, we felt very safe because the Coast Guard
staying
in our hotel. So we were in great shape, but they would go out, they would have dinner, and then they would go out every night and come back. We would see them at breakfast time as they were coming in, and we would see them at dinner time going out.
And in fact, it's so close that Puglia was part of the Magna Graecia. So was part of the ancient Greek Empire.
And you remember?
And actually a lot of the food tradition also share a lot of ingredients and a lot of technique in general with the Mediterranean area.
One of the things Anne will remember, she'll remember I mentioned it now, because on one of our excursions, we needed to take some wine back. In fact, I think we needed to take a lot of wine back for the Coast Guards. And we didn't know where to find it. And we found what we could only describe as
stuff I've ever had in my life.
It was like a filling station. It was like a gas station for wine.
You bought a jug?
You bought a jug.
And you pumps, like gas station pumps,
you filled your jug. And it was still lira in those days, but it was the equivalent of about $1.50 you could fill your jug.
It was so bad.
So we took two, and it wasn't very good wine.
Yeah, exactly. I think that in the last 10 years, they have refined very much the production of wine. In the past, very often the wine was used to be mixed with other wines. And now in the last probably 10, 15 years, they've started to produce high quality wine, and there is also a lot of natural wine that is really interesting and has changed completely the idea of the wine from Puglia. And
we have
the Primitivo or other that are becoming really interesting and good wine.
We have found that absolutely that is true, that back in 1998 you could still say that Puglia was a land of many many grapes and lots of bad wine, but that is obviously changing. And together with opinions about, by the way, is Primitivo really Zinfandel or is Zinfandel really Primitivo, and other controversies of the interesting kind.
Yeah, always.
Now, is there, I know not only from town to town, but even from family to family, recipes differ. And also in Puglia, they're like Sicily, a corridor sector, so that everybody has come through and left an influence. But if you were to characterize Puglia's cuisine and also contrast it with Basilicata, how would you do that? Let's start with
this. I think that the Basilicata cuisine is even more cucina povera than the Puglia. That is already a cuisine that is based on very humble ingredients. The region has been a very poor region for a long time. And so, for example, the meat, there is a lot of consumption of lamb, and because the beef was very, very expensive. And because there was a very low production of beef. And so the entire cuisine is very much built around humble ingredients that are not expensive. So you have the tomato, you have, for example, things like the wild fennel, a lot of wild herbs, the broccoli, the cima di rapa, all vegetables that grow very quickly. They grow everywhere. And the interesting thing is that then they are accompanied by two other main ingredients, that's the garlic and the chili, that with which you can transform and doing amazing things with these very humble ingredients.
Well, I mean, it's certainly delicious and varied, very varied. And there are recipes in this book that, I mean, I keep looking at these chestnut things that look fabulous.
But you can see that if you go through the ingredients, you will see that it's always the same kind of ingredient that are used in a very creative way, and they are all ingredients that you can find everywhere.
Right.
So it's a very harsh land because it's very hot during the summer. It's relatively cold in winter. So it's not, someone joking was saying that it's similar to California, but actually it's not, because the climate is much harsher. So the produce that grows easily are this kind of very strong ingredients that they almost grow by themselves, so that they don't need a lot of attention and that you can have in your backyard. And around these ingredients, they were able to create really, really tasty recipes.
Well, I'm looking forward to cooking my way through this book. And so
they're very simple. They are very simple. They don't put too many ingredients.
Yeah, I mean,
it doesn't take too much time.
I like orecchiette with broccoli, Rob. So I'm fine.
The orecchiette, you can make them themselves, but you can also easily buy them already made. So it's really the sauce that is fantastic.
Well, we're going to go back to Puglia as a result of your book, even though we were already thinking about it. You've made us decide. So whether it'll be this year or next year, it'll be soon. Listeners, if you're smart, you'll get there in the next few years, because it's only going to become more and more popular and more congested. And you'll enjoy it more if it's as you just described it.
Yeah, and if you can just avoid the very, very hot months of the year, July and August, and May, June, and September are wonderful months to be there.
Well, Amelia, I mean, it's not going to take this long for us to talk again, so maybe we'll meet over Sicilia next.
Yeah, great, definitely.
Great talking
to you. And there are other regions that are not very well known. We will come up with books very, very, very soon.
Great. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us about the Silver Spoon and the regional cooking books.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Amelia. Ciao, ciao.
Ciao.
And don't go away, because we've got another interesting segment coming up after the break, all about the world's greatest restaurants.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And next, here we are. If you're out and about and traveling, you're going to certainly want to know where you're going to eat. Now, these are not like only top restaurants. This is seriously insider scoop on where chefs eat. One of our favorite characters, Joe Warwick, has just offered this up as a second edition. It's like twice the size of the first one. And he gets to eat out a lot.
Yeah, Joe's an interesting character. He had a lot to do with establishing the world's 50 best restaurant awards when he was a journalist working for Restaurant Magazine in the UK. And I guess it's a natural extension of that he would chat with chefs around the world. So he did it in a very disciplined fashion. And as Anne said, this is the second version, the 2015 edition, which is
big,
50% bigger than the 2013 original issue, and something that if you travel a lot around the world, you're going to want to lay your hands on. And guess what? There's an app that goes along with it, too.
I love the app, but go ahead.
Yes, yeah, so let's hear it from Joe Warwick. Most people think that the largest book in the English language is the Holy Bible or the London A to Z book of maps, which we all used to own. I think it's only now owned by taxi drivers. But along came Joe Warwick. Was it 2 years ago or 3 years ago?
We first did this 2 years ago.
With a magnificent tome called Where Chefs Eat. And we said, Joe, when you update this, which we're not sure you'll know how to do, you'll have to come back on the program again. So here we are, updated, heavier than ever. How did you pull it off?
Well, it's more of the same, really. We've kept the questions the same in terms of surveying the chefs. So we've got 600 chefs this time. We had 400 last time.
I thought it was bigger.
we had, I think, slightly over 2,000 restaurants last time. This time we've got slightly over 3,000 restaurants. So the whole thing's increased by a third. Same thing, we surveyed the chefs. We asked them to pick their favorite places for breakfast to late night, for bargain eats to high end, places they wished to open, places that they, the last place they came across in their travels that they thought was great, favorite local place, like something they could only find in their city or their region that they didn't think they could find anywhere else. And we resurveyed all the chefs from the first time, so they changed some of their choices.
Oh, they did change them. That's good.
Some of them did change some of their choices, or places had closed, or they didn't think, yeah, they didn't. They maybe found another place they liked for breakfast or whatever. And then we talked to a lot more chefs. So I thought we put the biggest effort into expanding the coverage in the States beyond the obvious places. So places like Austin, Texas, like Houston, like Charleston, more kind of regional American cities.
So you've added chefs from those regions.
We've added chefs from those regions. We've bulked up. So just, you know, I mean, never claiming to do the whole world. We'd need, 100 volumes this size to do the whole world. Like you said, it's a big book. It's about the size of the size Oxford Dictionary. It's just shy of 1,000 pages. We weren't trying to do the whole world, but we wanted to try and look at maybe where we could have covered things a little bit better than last time, and that's where we expanded the coverage.
Now let's talk now about the individual entries.
Of course, the
book itself is organized by geography?
Yeah, it's arranged continentally, and then big countries we obviously divide up. So the States, for example, we've divided it roughly into West Coast and East Coast, and then by city, Europe countries, South America, North and South. So it's divided continentally and then regionally within those countries and by country in the smaller countries.
Now, for each one of the entries, then, the standard entry goes like, this is the name of the restaurant, this is its address, this is its phone number, this is its website, and then comment about that restaurant if there was one offered.
Yes, so basically we've opening hours, will they take credit cards, price range, style, cuisine, what it was recommended for, and then a snappy quote from one of the chefs that recommended it. We've also got the names of all the chefs if there was more than one that recommended the restaurant. And so they're putting their names on these restaurants. And I think when we talked about this before, I think that's what the great thing is. I think I said to you before, and I think it's still true, if you go to one of these restaurants and it's got a chef's name on it and it's no good for what they've recommended it for, that's as bad as going to one of their restaurants and having a bad meal. So I think that they've put their names on these places and are saying, this is where I like to go for my cheap thrills, or I like to go for my late night feast, or I like to go for breakfast. The fact that they're saying that, I think, really means.
Now, how are you supposed to use this book?
Well, that's what I was going to come to next, because there are, having said that, you can look at it geographically, you also might want to look at it in a number of different ways, and you have not just one or two, but three or four different indexes.
Yes, so I can search by chef. You can kind of flick through it, and just flicking through it now. There's cheap, fast, and delicious regional Thai cuisine, products cooked with care and knowledge. So, you know, the pull quotes, as I describe them, kind of jump out at you. So you can flick through it and kind of, I suppose, travel by flicking through the page. I'm going from Australia to Finland to Catalonia just by, you know, flicking through it. So that's a nice thing to do. You can search as well. We've got a whole lot of lists in the back for the various categories. So you can go through all the places that are worth the travel. You can go through all the places that are good for breakfast. And then there's an index with the name of all the different restaurants in it as well. We've also got an app that we've done a lot of work on between this time. There was an app last time, but it was a very basic app. This app, I think, is a lot slicker, and technology's come on a bit in the last couple of years, the way these things move. So you can take the whole book with you in your pocket, on your iPhone or your iPad, and you can search through it in the same way. And it's also got this location services, so you have a Near Me button. So if you're walking past one of the restaurants, the 3,000 odd places that are in there, and you're nearby, it'll pop up.
Oh,
or
that's
you can
very
press,
clever.
Press near me, and it'll come up with all the list of the places that are near you and
that's
how far away
they are.
That's
pretty cool. You're getting cool here, Joe.
Yeah, no, and the app is called Where Chefs Eat?
It's Where Chefs Eat as well, and it's for your iPad or for your iPhone, and you get that from the Apple Store.
Coming from an old journalist background, I have a question. How in the world do you fact check this much information?
Well, I'd like to pretend. No, I wouldn't. I don't like pretending. I'd like to say it was all me. But no, we had a team of guys working on this. So we came up with a list of chefs that we wanted to contribute. We contacted all the chefs from before. We added a list of some more. And it was a case of sending out emails, chasing them up. And then it was a case of we went through it and we checked it. And we made phone calls and we checked stuff online and did all of those things. I'm sure, inevitably, between it going to press and now, there's probably something that's closed changed address or whatever. That's inevitable. I mean, that's the other nice thing about apps. I love books. I think books are wonderful. But the thing is, if somewhere closes, you can take it off the app, or if the address changes or the telephone number changes or the chef changes, you can update the content very easily. You can't do that with a book, but books are beautiful, and I think it's nice. I'm just holding it in my hands. I'm looking at its beauty. Orange this time instead of teal. Orange is obviously the trendy color for art directors at the moment.
Actually, the color of the year is, what is it? It's like a burgundy. Merlot.
Oh, we've got burgundy now.
It's Merlot is the color of the year.
Merlot.
Yeah.
Okay. maybe 2017 will go Merlot.
Yeah, the only reason they do Merlot is that when you spill wine on it, you can't see it.
Probably.
That's true. And it probably, this is a light. Obviously, greasy fingers as well. You want something that doesn't show up your greasy fingers so much. But
we have a book. It's the sad part of it, it's actually a lending library book that we've had out more than once from the library. And it's got special marking on the side.
Oh, that's awful from when I was pitting the cherries.
It got sprayed when Anne was using the cherry pitter to put up.
But I love that with cookbooks where you've got a recipe that you've obviously used a lot of times, and it's got the ingredients all over it.
Yeah, but this is
lovely.
The property of Carnegie Library. Tell me this. I've asked you this. You obviously do not go to all these places.
Good God. I mean, I wish I had, but no, I hadn't. I mean, this is the chef's choices.
Yeah,
they're not my choices.
But you do hang out with a lot of chefs, don't you?
I hang out with a fair amount of chefs. I mean, I've just come back from the exciting thing I've done so far this year. Probably one of the most exciting things I will do this year is I've just come back from Japan, from Tokyo. So I went out to see what Noma were doing in Tokyo.
Did you go?
I went. Not only did I go, I didn't get a reservation, but they made a little chef's table for me in the kitchen on a Saturday night.
That's what they've been doing because the New York Magazine dining critic, he got a little table too.
So the basic, it's right in the corner of the kitchen in the pub.
Right.
So every time they opened the plate warmer, you'd get a gust of hot air between your legs, which wasn't completely unpleasant. but to be able to and then look out on the restaurant. So, and then what I also did, the story I was doing was I worked two shifts front of house because I used to work in restaurants. I spent a decade working in restaurants front of house. So I managed to talk them into letting me work a lunch and a dinner in the restaurant to see it from that side. So I ate behind the pass and I worked in front of the pass.
Oh, that's great.
What are a couple of your ladies' favorite places in London?
Favorite place by a long way that's opened recently is called Lyle's, and that's in Shoreditch. A chef is called James Lowe. Now, James used to work at St. John Bread and Wine back in the day, a few years ago, and he's been traveling around doing various things. So it's kind of St. John Bread and Wine meets what they're doing at the Clove Club, but with much more modern techniques. It's very, very simple, very seasonal, but really clever cooking. And I think he's a real star, this guy.
A fan of the Clove Club. But anyhow.
Well, this is better than the Clove Club. Okay. This is, so during the lunchtime, well, it's not better, it's different. So lunchtime, there's an a la carte. In the evening, he does a little four-course menu. The room looks a lot like St. John. It's very white and kind of utilitarian. They're into their natural wines, which I know is a bit divisive, but they've got some great natural wines. They're not all incredibly crazy ones.
Hey, back to this book, I want to know is, you must really get sort of carried away with these answers, the responses coming in. And what surprises can you relate? Were you really, really surprised by anybody's pick?
I wasn't really surprised, but I think because we're asking them to pick restaurants for, and they're not all restaurants, of course, there's hot dog stands in there, there's seafood shacks, there's all sorts of things, as we discussed before, so I'm not really surprised because the places they recommend tend to be for the category. I was surprised that some chefs thought I was so silly that they could recommend their own restaurants or restaurants that they were involved in, and that I wouldn't notice. So we caught them out on that.
Isn't that unusual?
So no kind of surprises, because I'm quite open-minded. I think, again, when we talked about this before, and I think it's true, still true, is the fancier the restaurant, the fancier the chef, the more casual, laid-back their choices might be. And if anyone thinks very high-end chefs only eat in other high-end restaurants, they're sorely mistaken.
Oh,
I think that's not what they want when they relax, and they'll go to those places to see what's going on.
I know they like junk food, and they like cheap Asian places. I know that.
A lovely, great late-night Szechuan place, or a fantastic hot dog, or great diner. All of these things have their currency in the right circumstances, and that's the sort of places that they found that are in there. Along with, in the Wish I'd Open category, is Lake Nome. It's quite interesting. I did the 10 most picked places. I did a top 10. I haven't got it here, but
it kind of
equated with the 50 best. It was
that
all
was
those sort
your
of places.
Idea.
So,
the 50 best was your idea.
Yeah, I was involved in that. But the kind of restaurants that that were most picked repeatedly by chefs were places like Noma, Asador, Extra Barry, places like that would have you'd find in the 50 best. And they're great, but we all know about those places. They're all wonderful. they all tend to be expensive. They're all hard to get into. So I think it's the quirky little places, the hot dog stands and the burger bars and the place that does the great Hamon sandwich. Those are the places that I think are more unexpected discoveries.
I have to tell you, we did the 50 best in London. We do that every year. And then we missed the Singapore one or whatever it was. We did the 50 best Latin American run. And I was interviewing at one of these things. I was interviewing Thomas Keller, and he said, you know what they're going to do next is the 50 best restaurants in Puerto Rico.
Well, it's getting that way. I mean, the thing's got momentum. It's going anywhere. I'm proud to have been involved in starting it. I do think it's a bit silly I've said this to you before, the reason that I kind of like this book is because it's not just all about those kind of restaurants, which are wonderful and we love eating in, but best for what? The 50 best was never meant to be that. It was meant to be a much more eclectic list of different places, high-end, low-end, in-between, fantastic locations. And it's turned into a list of three-star Michelin restaurants, or mostly three-star Michelin restaurants.
Tell me this, Joe. I have to ask you this. This is such a big undertaking. I would think you'd have to start immediately working on your next update, because it's so big, except that it can't do it that far in advance, because, as you mentioned, the places close, or they're not closed, or whatever they do. So, like, how do you do this?
Well, I think we'll sit down and we'll probably have a meeting in the summer, and we'll see if this is something they want to do again in another. Thank you for fitting me in time.
I'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Okay, Anne.
Okay, ciao.
Time sure goes quickly at On the Menu Radio, does it not? and so we're already ready to say goodbye until next week, same time, same place, when we hope you'll join us. And until then,
bye-bye.